This episode is brought to you by Avid Reader Press. Legendary investor Ray Dalio's new book, How Countries Go Broke, The Big Cycle, explains the mechanics behind big debt crises. Larry Summers says Dalio's brilliant, iconoclastic approach is an invaluable resource. Hank Paulson says it provides a solution to what is the biggest and most certain threat to our prosperity. And the Financial Times warns policymakers would do well to pay attention to his concerns. Get your copy wherever books are sold.
Growth's been the big theme of the week. Are you optimistic, Robert?
No more than I was last week. We'll see. A lot of words. Let's see where it amounts to.
Miranda.
I'm very optimistic because I got the memo. We're all optimistic now, right? There's no more gloom and doom, Lucy. It's not allowed.
Peter.
And not in the short term, but I think there are reasons potentially for optimism in the longer term if some things that haven't happened in a very long time do happen, which is a reason not to be optimistic.
Welcome to Political Fix from the Financial Times with me, Lucy Fisher. Coming up, Rachel Rees has a plan to kickstart the UK's economic growth. But will it also kickstart battles within the Labour Party? Plus, the Prime Minister heads to Brussels to discuss an EU pact on security and defence next week. We'll examine what to expect. I'm joined in the studio by my FT colleagues Miranda Green. Hi, Miranda.
Hello, Lucy.
And Robert Shrimsley. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Lucy.
And the FT's public policy editor, Peter Foster. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Lucy.
So the big moment of this week was Rachel Reeves' speech on economic growth in Oxfordshire on Wednesday, setting out a raft of measures to try and catalyse the UK economy. We had new housing, transport and infrastructure developments, a big push on the Oxford-Cambridge arc. We'll get into the details on that. Lots on airport capacity and most notably political support for a third runway at Heathrow. I'm keen just to get a sense from you all of your kind of broad take on the speech. Peter, starting with you.
I thought the delivery was disappointing. Just a reminder that not only is the Prime Minister not a brilliant retail politician, but nor is the Chancellor. You know, she's not great on Q&A. If she was a CEO of a company and she was trying to make you buy her product, I'm not sure you would have been bowled over. In terms of the content, some big statements of intent, you know, with international implications, Heathrow, the Oxford-Cambridge arc, Old Trafford regeneration in Manchester, all of that sends a sign that we're open for business. But of course, still no money. We know we've got no money. And therefore, when you get into the weeds of it, they are relying on the private sector to deliver a lot of these big projects. And a lot of them are not that viable without quite a lot of government money.
Robert?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a lot of things to like about the speech itself in terms of what she's committed the government to doing, the direction of travel, the ambition for the country. It was all very positive and things that people have wanted to see. But it is essentially still a bit of a sort of illusion. It's a bit of an attempt to change the mood without anything actually having happened, because a lot of the projects that she's talked about, the Oxford-Cambridge arc, as Peter said, very worthy of support, these things are going to take years. The Heathrow thing, you know, we won't be doing this podcast when that ever happens, if it ever happens. And, you know, the planning reforms that they were pushing last year as well, all good. Let's see them in practice. So my feeling was it was all the right things, but you want to see real action. And against that, of course, is still the fact that in the second half of last year, they backed up business taxes and they're driving through an employment rights bill, which business hates and is going to make further costs on business. So they're still facing two ways on this a bit. And I think that's still a problem.
Mm. Well, I want to get into some of the detail of that, but Miranda, your take first.
I suppose, like my colleagues, I am pleased to hear them kind of will the ends, but wonder the extent to which they're willing the means. And particularly what I noticed was the absence of anything really about human capital and about what you might call the kind of human infrastructure that you need to build the physical infrastructure. Because, you know, there's a massive shortage of construction workers. We know that, 250,000 short. On lots of different levels, you have to actually have a kind of labour plan and a workforce plan and a skills plan to support this kind of growth agenda, even over the medium term, let alone in the short term. So I think that's a really big hole in it. And it was a bit odd not to mention it. And if you're going to have growth, you've got to do something about productivity. And a big ingredient in that is skills.
Mm. Well, for me, one of the key takeaways was Rachel Reeves trying to signal her willingness to have a fight for economic growth and to prioritise it over other competing concerns, most notably, I think, in the measure she announced this week, over environmentalism and NIMBYism. Robert, that stores up a lot of problems for her politically, doesn't it? Not least, you know, Heathrow, the big kind of argument there is about, you know, that will ride roughshod over the UK's carbon budget and legally binding commitments to achieving net zero by 2050. So far, we haven't heard much sort of resistance from Ed Miliband. He's made clear he's not going to resign over it, although he did threaten to resign over the same issue at the tail end of Gordon Brown's government. Sadiq Khan also concerned. Where do you see this fight going?
It's really interesting. I mean, I think one of the things that slightly helps them is a lot of the seats are on what might call the yellow flight path of Lib Dem seats, so they're not that worried about it. That's an overgeneralisation. Of course, there are Labour seats too. But I think if you look at where they are pointing, which is this rhetoric of growth number one priority, anything in its way will be dealt with, it rubbed up against the two things that Labour was actually clear about in the election, which was that it had this huge green agenda and it had this huge employment rights agenda. And both of those things were the two really explicit pledges they made. And those are the two things that are partly in the way. So the question, I mean, I think in the end, the Heathrow stuff will probably be fine just because everyone looks at it and goes, well, that's not happening anytime soon. And so they can be angry about it, but it's probably not going to get very far. And, you know, Ed Miliband's not going to resign over it. So there'll be rumblings and rows, but I don't know that it's a real problem. But the employment rights stuff, I think, is much more serious because that's stuff going through Parliament now. There are major parts which re-empower the trade unions in lots of ways, which give rights to people from day one. Now, you may think this is right, but business is deeply concerned about the extra regulations and pressures it will find itself under. And I think that's the real fight they've got to have. And I don't know how much appetite they have for it. I watched Keir at PMQs this week, and he wasn't the voice of someone who thought he was really going to row back on that.
It gives it a slight air of desperation, doesn't it? You know, that they've backed themselves into a corner with a budget that suppressed hiring, suppressed investment, and very quickly soured their relationship with business. And now it feels like, rather than, you know, lighting the afterburners under the rebuilding of Britain, they're in a sort of U-turn phase where they're desperately trying to get the thing going. On the Oxford-Cambridge art, the other thing I think is that very adversarial thing that you mentioned, we're going to blast through, we're going to power on through, get rid of the bats, onwards, onwards, onwards. You know, when I spoke
to
local...
It's a bad week to be a bat, isn't it?
Poor bats, yeah. But when I spoke to local council leaders, the Oxford-Cambridge arc, initially that hit the buffers under the Tories because they ran around saying they were going to build 1 million extra homes. And there was a massive NIMBY backlash. Now, if you look at what they call a high growth trajectory on the arc, they are going to have to build 15,000 homes a year in Oxford, Cambridge and Milton Keynes. That is three times what they're currently building. And both of the local leaders, Mike Davey, who runs Cambridge City Council, who's Labour, and Lucy Netzinger, who runs Cambridgeshire County Council, who's Lib Dem, both said the same thing, unprompted, which is this will not work unless the government gets into the positive side of this. So rather than just saying we're going to bash it through, that actually this is going to be good. It's going to be good for your families. It's going to be good for your children. They're going to have somewhere to live. They're going to have good jobs and all the rest of it. And they're going to have to really try and sell that because there is going to be a lot of opposition on the ground.
Mm-hmm. I think, Robert, you make a very interesting point on Heathrow. We've heard the estimate of Michael O'Leary, the Ryanair boss, that we aren't going to see spades in the ground till 2050, you know, far beyond the next election. So in a way, that announcement might be more symbolic, talking about Britain being open for business. And it's obviously such a huge symbol to sort of foreign investors as our largest airport hub. But what you mentioned about the employment rights legislation, that is coming right down the line. And you picked up PMQs where Kemi Badenoch went on the attack, pointing out that by the government's own estimation, this will cost businesses £5 billion extra a year. Miranda, where do you think the government's going to get to on this? I mean, Angela Rayner, it's her flagship project. She's not going to roll over without a fight. On the other hand, those who think they understand Morgan McSweeney's motivations and where he stands on this issue think he might be more willing or primed to water some parts of it down.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, you were asking earlier, where will the cabinet battle come over this growth agenda? And maybe it won't be Ed Miliband and the climate sort of setback. Maybe it will actually be, you know, Starmer versus Rayner. I mean, I have to say, I've thought for a long time that that package of Labour reforms would not end up looking much like the original sort of proposals that we've been writing about before and since the election. It seemed to me it was always in trouble. And the more that you irritate business about other things, the more you're going to have to water that down, right? So, you know, it's a sort of casualty of the next rise, in a sense. So I'd be amazed if it got through unscathed. But you're right, there could be a lot of fireworks in cabinet.
Robert, you're shaking your head.
I'm a bit more sceptical than Miranda. I mean, everything Miranda said is right, and logic says that should be what happens. But I just think they really believe in this bill. You know, and even Rachel Reeves may have cooled on it, but fundamentally, this is a government with a very strong sort of, its leaders have a very strong working class mentality, and they believe in, we are doing things to help working people. The balance of power shifted against them, and this bill is about helping them and giving them rights at work, and I think they think it's sellable. So I'm sure there will be fudges here and there, timing of implementation, maybe the probation periods, but I sort of broadly think they believe in this. Mm. So I personally would be surprised if it's heavily watered down.
That's interesting, because of course what they're saying at the moment is, to critics on the right, you know, you opposed the national minimum wage on exactly the same grounds and, you know, warned, as it turned out, wrongly, that that would lead to, you know, all sorts of jobs going and the collapse of the economy, and that didn't happen.
But of course, the minimum wage, I mean, you know, I was there that time around. And, you know, the thing about the minimum wage is they implemented it with the most extraordinary caution. I mean, the minimum wage at first implementation was like 50p and a lollipop. It really wasn't very much money. And they were deliberately undershot to make sure that it didn't hit businesses very much. So they had a deep sense of caution in the way they did it last time. And I don't know if the same sense of caution is quite here yet this time around.
But your question is really interesting, Lucy, isn't it? Because what is the Morgan McSweeney? And I don't mean him literally. I mean that sort of take. What is the bit that's actually important for mission, let's win the next election? Because, you know, if people vote in a Labour government with that explicit set of promises, isn't that what they expect? So if you row back on it too much, what is your government about? I think you do get into some real problems of political definition, actually.
But Peter, one of the potentials here is for this to blow up in Labour's face. If they empower the unions, removing all these curbs on strikes, we could see a whole new round of industrial action just as we're heading into the next election. Snarling up the public sector.
No, and I think that, you know, that is going to be tricky, particularly when they began by giving these public sector pay deals to the unions. You know, already now the NEU, which is quite left-wing, big teaching union, is spoiling for a fight over the putative 2.8% that they might give teachers. And actually, normally government's quite careful when, you know, when you ask the press office for a line on these things, they're normally quite mealy-mouthed. They weren't this time. They said, you know, teachers have had 17% over 2 years. They need to get on teaching. But it is, you're right, going to be tricky, because there's an awful lot of people going to be saying, well, hang on, you bung them loads of money and now we're back where we started. And actually, we haven't had productivity improvements. So, you know, they're the train drivers still working to rule on overtime, etc. And I do think if the government is as weak then as it looks now, you know, that is a pretty open goal for the right.
You do have this sense, don't you, of a government that just isn't very good at looking far down the line. It's not very good at seeing the corner after the corner they're turning now. And these issues that seem okay now, but cuter operators might be able to see a little further ahead.
But what do you think also, Lucy, because isn't one of the massive pitfalls also the conversation it has to open up on immigration because of the Labour implications of all this building and all this infrastructure work? And that's the conversation they won't have. I mean, lots of people were joking on the day of Rachel Reeves' speech. Who's actually going to do this? Are we all going to have to volunteer? You know, is there going to be an infrastructure draft and we'll all be trained to pour concrete? Because, you know, at a certain point, without the imported labour in the short term, how do you do it?
The other thing about it I thought was, I was slightly surprised by, was how southern it really was. Now, there were lots of northern announcements, but they were like, you know, your token northern. I mean, there's going to be another go at Doncaster Airport, a completely failed airport. We're going to have another go at it. There's a reheating of an Old Trafford initiative that was already underway. It was like, you could see the, what have we got for Lancashire? Oh, we'll have that. You know, there's a bit of that going on. But the really big stuff is all very much in the south. And it points to a sort of attitude where it's going back to a focus on GDP as the headline number rather than GDP per head and living standards. And you just wonder how this will play out, if even if it works, in terms of making people outside of the southeast feel better off.
Yeah, I mean, Peter, critics have immediately leapt on the focus on the south and the southeast in the announcements this week. Is it RIP levelling up?
No, I'm not sure that it is. It's interesting. The government's acutely aware of this criticism. And there are two things going on. One is the devolution piece, the local growth plans, the regional transport initiatives, all of that, and the rejigging of the Green Book, the Treasury's famous Green Book, to make it easier to do cost-benefit analysis.
This is the rejigging of the Green Book that was rejigged under the Tories.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. we can come back to that.
You're saying it's a de-jig?
But what I'm saying is that...
Just remind our listeners what the Green Book is.
The way in which the Treasury does cost-benefit analysis of these projects. And obviously, if you add one stop to a train that runs through a high-productive area of the southeast, you get a really good number. But, you know, what's the case for doing something outside Doncaster's failed airport? So you know, there has to be a way of scoring these projects so that you don't entirely build everything in the southeast. The trouble is, and what's interesting, and Andy Burnham's grumbling a bit, but everyone you talk to up north, the Northern Powerhouse Partnership, etc., are for the moment not complaining. And there are various journalists like me who've tried to get them to complain, and they haven't really been very willing to complain. There's a lot of talk about connected clusters. Big port came out that was done between Cambridge and the Northern Powerhouse Partnership, etc., about how levelling up made spatial regional economic geographies, to use the jargon, very adversarial, right? Very zero sum. And I think the regions are trying to avoid that happening again. And so they're keeping their powder dry. But, and here's the big but, in a world where the government doesn't have very much money or no money, the truth is the projects that are most viable, the projects for which you can raise public finance most easily, are in the south and the southeast. It's where the house builders want to build. It's where the infrastructure pays you the biggest bang for your buck. And so there is no getting away from that. And for a government that's desperate to drive economic growth, the truth is that the high productivity, high exporting, service orientated businesses are more in the south than they are in the north.
I wanted to get your sense of how much Rachel Reeves' ferocity of rhetoric and her enthusiasm in trying to talk up the economy mattered this week. I know she's been accused of talking down the economy previously, one of the key charges levelled against her. But is there something in this idea, Robert, that you can unleash animal spirits, she can piggyback off the sort of optimism, upbeatness of Trump across the Atlantic, or is that all nonsense?
I'm not a great believer in talking up and talking down the economy as a genuine political initiative. I think part of the problem is it's a bit like a magician's trick. If you know what she's up to politically, it stops working. So if everyone says this is an economic reset, she's now talking up the economy, then everyone goes, oh yeah, she's just talking. It doesn't work. So it has to be a process that's sort of almost unseen and continuous. And one of the things I think has been a failure of this government so far is it sort of has a one and done approach to communications. Like, I did my speech talking up the economy, so now I don't have to do that again. I mean, that's not Rachel Reeves's view, but I think there's a sense of you just got to keep at it. You've got to keep at this all the time till we're all as bored with the message as we were with knowing what Keir's father did in the general election. And I just feel at the moment the sort of the political seams are showing a bit too much. So they've just got to keep at this in a dull but consistent way for quite a long time.
Randall, what's your sense of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think show, don't tell is definitely what they should have been doing for a while. I mean, thinking back even to general election campaigns of the past, however sort of superficial and silly it seems at the time, it does work. I mean, think of George Osborne walking around in his high-vis jacket for the whole of the 2015 election with his hard hat on, saying, I have a plan. It kind of worked. You know, people actually want to sort of see the thing in motion. What I think is much more difficult for them is this change of tone and briefing, you know, the broadcasters on the day of Rachel Reeves' speech. We're going to see cranes in the air as, you know, demonstration that we're really turning the corner on the economy. Well, you know, as we've been discussing, those cranes aren't actually going to be in the air for quite some time, potentially, and who's going to be at the wheel. So I think the substantive problems are more in terms of demonstrating what you're doing, as Robert says, rather than just more verbiage. You know, this government so far, we've had months and months and months of, you know, targets and replans and resets and overarching missions and first steps and all the rest of it. It's verbiage, and that's actually not delivery. And that's the core problem
they've
got. And I think
the problem is that what they're doing is long term. Now, it may be that
absolutely.
In 5-7 years, we look back at this and go, that was great. That government really got a grip on things. But the problem is, when you're sinking in the polls and the economy is languishing, you need things to be happening now. So there's this gap, this lag between what they hope to achieve and when they're going to do it. And so they're trying to fill that, as Miranda says, with words. And and nobody's fooled, particularly since they have this other agenda, which is putting costs onto business. So it's, they're in a bit of a cleft stick.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the challenge is they're trying to do something that looks through political cycles. And if they were nailed on as a two-term government, which you would sort of expect they might have done, they won 180-seat majority, etc., then all this would feel very different. It would feel about laying the foundations that we're going to pay dividends down the track. She said, you know, the number one thing, my three pillars for growth, is political stability. But in some ways, that's what we don't have. Mm-hmm. We just had 8 years of Tory chaos, pinball policymaking driven by the Tory party settling its own internal factional differences. We then had a government that settled its factional differences out of office, killing Corbyn, etc. In they come. And if you're an investor and you're looking, you think, right, OK, now the UK, that was all a blip. That was a nightmare. The UK's got its stuff together and we're going to be on the track to growth. But actually what's happened is they look politically weak. It's not at all clear that they're going to slam it at the next election. Who knows what's going to happen with Tories and reform, etc. And so that ability to project the confidence that actually the UK has gone back to being a country where investors can look through political cycles and these long-term projects are going to be delivered over time. And the talk about planning reform, and which by the way, are some quite important things happening, are something that is really about a proper change of direction. And you look all across Europe and you look at America, and as an investor, it's hard to believe right now.
Well, certainly YouGov this week shows that Labour's approval ratings have reached their worst nadir since the election, now at minus 48. Keir Starmer is trying to draw an analogy with Thatcher, isn't he, in the 1980s, with talking up the big slashing of red tape, bonfire of regulation. Robert, do you buy into that being an apt analogy in any way?
First of all, Thatcher came in to a country that had that was in the most terrible trouble, but also where the prescription for addressing it, certainly if you were a Thatcherite conservative, was very clear. And the regulations that she got rid of, things like capital controls, these were enormous things that had an immediate impact. She you know, hammered back trade union power. She, as I said, removed capital controls. Much later on, there was the big bang in the city. This was a government with a very clear sense of what we've got to scythe through. What exactly of these regulations and controls that Keir Starmer wants to cite? There are issues. I'm not saying there aren't. You know, there are regulators who are too safety conscious, too risk averse. These are all things worth examining, but they're not the kind of things that you hack them down and suddenly it's a clearing. I think one of the issues, if this was a Conservative government, you would understand what they were about. This is a Conservative government saying we're all about growth. We're getting rid of obstacles to business. We're cutting back business taxes. We're cutting back regulation, flexible workforce, that kind of thing. And there would be a story, and there'd be a unity of a message, and people would get it. The problem here is there isn't that unity of message because they believe in different things. Mm. At different times, they want to spend more money. They don't want to cut back the state. They want a better state, but they don't want necessarily a smaller state. They want to improve workers' rights. You know, they do think businesses should pay more. So there is just this absolute confusion at the heart of it. And until they cut through that thicket, I don't see away past it.
Peter, one thing we haven't mentioned is the big EU reset. And like immigration, you know, two levers that this government could pull if it really is wanting to prioritise economic growth above all else, and yet both very politically fraught. Where do you think we're going to get to on that?
Nowhere fast is the short answer to that question. Robert was talking about the kind of internal contradictions. You know, this is a government in the manifesto says it wants to tear down the barriers to trade, but it's sticking with the same red lines, no single market, no customs union, etc., that created the barriers for the Brexit deal that Rachel Reeves in her speech called failed. And that's there at the heart of it. Why are they not doing that? They're doing that because they're frightened of the immigration piece. We saw a couple of things this week. The first sort of positive one is that they've now talked about linking the UK or relinking the UK and the EU's carbon markets. That's important because we're all about to impose these carbon border taxes to try and equalise carbon across the border. Huge bureaucratic burden on our businesses. If you link the two again, that makes that go away. They've also been open to join this thing called the Pan-Euro-Mediterranean Convention on Customs, which is a kind of rules of origin accumulation thing. Neither of those things are going to change the price of fish, but they are signals of ambition. But you and I wrote a story this week saying that the EU aren't going to do their security pact that the UK wants, legally non-binding, a little piddly thing that they already have with North Macedonia and Japan and South Korea and two or three other countries, until they get these guarantees on fish, until they get an offer on youth mobility. that all sounds incredibly 2017, like we're going back to the future. Why is that? Why are we, you know, with war in Ukraine, Trump menacing Europe, a chance, you know, the Prime Minister says he wants a rapprochement. Why have we gone back to the great French, no, nothing till we get our fish? The answer is because the Brits haven't put a prize on the table, right? They could have gone in early and said, look, we're going to do a deal on fish. Yes, we want a youth mobility deal. Come on, let's get it on. What they've managed to do is, just like with the budget, where they got into the recrimination phase of government before they'd even delivered anything, they've managed to get into the recrimination phase with the EU before they've even opened a negotiation. And now maybe there's going to be a summit in April, May, March time. Then there's going to have to be a mandate. My understanding from talking to people in Brussels is they're not even going to be seriously talking until September, maybe even October, after Brussels has had its summer. So anybody who thinks that the EU-UK reset is going to move the needle on Rachel Reeves' growth problem, it ain't.
Miranda, I'm feeling a bit deflated about the big meeting that Keir Starmer's going to have with his European counterparts in Brussels on Monday. Sounds like it could be a bit of a damp squib.
Well, it is difficult, isn't it, to remain cheery about these warmer relations, you know, because he did have that sort of burst of activity at the beginning of visiting the European capitals and, you know, warming up, you know, after the froideur post-Brexit. But yeah, it does. It feels also very difficult to swim against the sort of news cycle tide on this particular issue, I would say. I mean, for example, was it last week, the week before? It's all gone a bit blurry. But when Sefcovic seemed to make some really quite dramatic, you know, opening towards the UK and say, well, on customs, you know, we could really make progress here. And our government in London reacts with total sort of terror at a potential political backlash to something that really would solve a lot of problems for business on customs. So in a sense, you can understand if EU leaders, you know, even those crucial individuals like Sefcovic, feel that they're rebuffed every time by the UK. Robert's again shaking his head, looking disapproving even of my analysis.
No, I was not your analysis. I was thinking there's a couple of points one has to throw in. Number one is the EU in the last, you know, 10 months has been doing a lot of public negotiation. You know, it's been throwing these ideas out, be it youth mobility before the election. Terrible timing. And you just sort of feel, okay, they're putting these things out there, but actually, where there's good faith, some of this stuff will be coming through privately. And the other point I wanted to make was that we just have to remember that what's going on in Europe at the moment. Keir Starmer's going to the summit. Olaf Scholz, he'll be gone in a few weeks. Macron, he's massively enfeebled now. Von der Leyen clearly is still a powerful figure, but you can see pushing against her all the different ways that the regulatory instances, the Commission, have gone too far. So I mean, I think it's a curious thing. One has to allow for the fact that Europe itself is going through some quite serious political turmoil, and we don't quite know what its shape is going to be over the next year. One has to factor that. It also needs some wins. So I just think we're, you know, at the beginning of a negotiation, which we weren't very good at last time, but let's see how it plays out this time.
But it is really interesting though, isn't it? Because it comes back to what you and Peter were discussing earlier, which was the idea that actually in the UK, politics isn't newly stable, because all of these decisions feel incredibly fraught to Keir Starmer, because look at his position in the polls, look at the rise of Reform. You know, we've got this fragmenting electoral politics, which means that he can't actually make policy decisions in a sort of, you know, on merit way.
But
and that's quite difficult.
He's even trying
what are his policy
to,
decisions?
Like,
I mean,
do
you have the sense of someone who's sat there thinking, I know exactly what I want from our relationship with the EU. I know what I want to be at the end of these negotiations. I just don't have that sense. When you get beyond security and crime, and, you know, from what one hears, you know, issues around regulators, where he sits around obsessing about a particular issue with a particular regulator that he heard about while visiting a factory somewhere. I just don't get the sense that Keir Starmer has a lot of endpoints that he wants to get to, that he knows the star that he's steering by. And I think that's part of the problem.
But it is a kind of fundament to say we want to tear down the barriers to trade and then stick with, you know, that is basically the same cakeist nonsense that we had from Theresa May at the beginning of this whole process. There's a difference, though, now, which is when they wrote that manifesto, you know, presumably Rachel Reeves said, oh, well, how much growth can we get from leaving the EU? And the answer is, well, not very much unless you start rejoining the single market, etc. We can't do that because of the immigration piece. So they put a red line through it from the outset. And the difference now is the EU has got a trade deal with the UK, right? The cliff edges that we're all used to driving the negotiation, they don't exist. So insofar as there ever was going to be an actual reboot that really made a difference to the people who kind of move things and make things, it was up to us to put something on the table to get the thing moving.
Mm.
And in the absence of us doing that, inertia has just reasserted itself, and the European Commission and the member states, for whom, by the way, an expansive UK negotiation would have been quite complicated. If we had gone in hard at the start, it starts all those divisions that Barnier tamped down by just having this very, very simple, no cherry picking, no nothing. Because actually, if you want to do a sui generis relationship with the UK and start to do complicated things, that is a version of cherry picking. But you have to reach the point where they go, okay, right, you've served
it's
your
time. Cherry picking. We're now in favour.
You've done your, you know, you've learned your lesson. Yeah. Okay, now let's have a bit of cherry picking because it works for all of us, right? And we've just completely. I mean, talking to some people in government, the levels of frustration at the ineptitude of the way the negotiation has been handled so far, the unnecessary corner in which we've backed ourselves.